Welcome to CRR Radio from the Vision 2020 Project.
Hi, my name is Ed Camo from the Vision 2020 Project. Today on CRR Radio, we're talking about NFPA 3000, Standard for an Active Shooter Hostile Event Response Program. This is a new standard that was put out by NFPA in late April. And today we're joined by John Montes, the Emergency Services Specialist from the NFPA, who is the staff liaison for the standard, and committee members Lori Moore Merrill, who is the Assistant to the General President from the IFF, and Massachusetts State Fire Marshal Peter Ostrowski. John, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us what NFPA 3000 is all about?
Sure. So NFPA 3000 is a new and provisional standard, only the second provisional standard in the history of the NFPA, that is for an active shooter hostile event response program. It's a first of its kind, and even though it says provisional in the title, it is a ANSI accredited, out there in the world, registered standard.
Thanks, John. And I'll be getting back to you in a minute looking for more details. But Lori, why was the standard created in the first place? What was the driving force behind it?
Well, I think that there was quite a demand from the fire service itself to have a standard. You see, prior to this, we had no real guidance from any authoritative source that would have provided us general guidelines even on how to put together joint responses with law enforcement, though many departments had done it. There were lots of variations, and the increasing number of incidents with this active shooter, any sort of hostile event type responses, a lot of our departments were being thrown into the mix and just having to do the best they could. Other departments had done some training, joint training, and we are seeing now the after effects and a lot of the lessons learned, if you will, post-incident on who had done training prior, joint training, working together, preparing, and those who had not. And it was very, very relevant to the situation and the outcomes of the situation, honestly. So there was quite a demand from the fire service, particularly, for some sort of standard that would help us pull together some details, some guidelines, some points to give some direction to the local agencies on how to do this and how to prepare. Specifically, the request came out of Orange County, Florida, with Chief Otto Droids, who made the request to NFPA with lots of backing, both from the IFF, the IFC, and the Metro Chiefs, all saying, yes, we need something. So the original request came from Chief Droids, and here we are.
So it certainly looks like there is a need for it. And tragically, these incidents seem to keep happening on a regular basis. Marshal Ostrowski, was that the driving urgency for developing 3000?
I joined the NFPA 3000 committee while it was already in progress. But it was impressive that NFPA, for only the second time in the organization's history, adopted this standard using a provision in the standards adoption process that enabled them to quickly get a product out. And that's really reflective of the times and the urgent need for this. But I think certainly the user community and NFPA really raised the issue that a timely document was necessary. So they took steps to make sure that this happened fast.
Back to you, John. And in looking at the committee that was developing the standard, it's not only quite large, but also very diverse. What was behind the selection of the committee members?
It is, yeah. So we have, now it's up to 50 members, representation from across all the law enforcement disciplines, local, federal, and state. Representation across all the fire service, EMS separate of the fire service, emergency management, universities. There's 9 physicians on the committee. The other thing that there's 9 of that I think is really interesting, there's 9 people that were actually survivors and or responders to recent active shooter events. So there's someone that was at Sandy Hook, someone that was at Las Vegas, 2 or 3 people that were at Pulse, someone that was at the Oak Creek shooting in Wisconsin at the Sikh temple. So these people have been in it. You know, we have someone that was shot 15 times on the committee and he survived. And, you know, his experience and his understanding of what occurred provides an invaluable resource, especially when you look at things like recovery.
And as I mentioned earlier, John, I was going to ask you for more details about just what is in the standard.
So there's, I'll just kind of go in order, very high level. There's a risk assessment both for a community and a facility. There's the program requirements. So if you're developing an active shooter hostile event response program, either as a community or a facility, who needs to be at the table is in there, and then what plans and guidelines that are part of that, those minimum things you need are in there. It just sets the minimum, and it doesn't say what's in those plans and guidelines because those are local capabilities and local tactics. It just says you need to have one for these things. Talks about resource distribution, talks about unified command, communication center coordination, which is your dispatch centers for 911. Responder competencies. So this is a really interesting section. Basically, the committee put together a list of competencies, and competency means knowledge of. It doesn't mean that you have to demonstrate it. That would be qualification. But knowledge of certain items. And the best example is threat-based medical care. So it says that all first responders, police, fire, and EMS have to have knowledge of threat-based medical care, which is really bleeding control. So it set up competencies. It actually set them up as separate chapters, one for police and one for fire and EMS. They included the EMS one with fire because they found that there was only a few things that were different, and they laid those out in the chapter instead of making a separate chapter that pretty much read the same. So they made competencies for law enforcement, competencies for fire and EMS, public notification, public education, that you have to teach communities how to prepare, respond, and recover for these events. And really that goes back to, you know, some of the things that are out there already, like bleeding control, stop the bleed, run, hide, fight, avoid, deny, defend, whatever your program is. It doesn't specifically pick one, just says you need to teach something. And then another interesting chapter, which is facilities chapter, facility readiness. And in that chapter, it says that the facility has to have a plan as part of its annex to its emergency operations plan. That plan has to be exercised on an annual basis. If the facility does an annual fire drill, then it has to do a drill of some kind, an exercise of some kind for its active shooter hostile event plan. And in that, the committee actually wrote it in a way to give facilities some flexibility, because they didn't say that it has to be the whole plan, it could be part of the plan. They also said that the facility doesn't have to do a full-scale boots on the ground exercise. They actually listed functional exercises and tabletop exercises as options to give facilities even more flexibility. And they also said, if you have a campus, you know, I'll use Harvard University. They have 200 facilities, 200 buildings. They said it's okay to do one for the campus, not just for every single facility. Instead of doing every single facility, you can do the campus. It has a continuity of operations chapter, has a recovery chapter, and that one's really interesting because it focuses on recovery from these types of events and how it's different from a disaster. So the best example I can give you there is in a disaster, under the National Disaster Response Framework from FEMA, there's a phase of recovery called short-term recovery. And the committee said there's no such thing as short-term recovery in an active shooter hostile event. You don't get back into your house, you don't get your power turned back on, and your services restored, and you're fine. This recovery goes on for years and years in perpetuity. So you have to plan for it differently. So they have a lot of information there on that. And then the last chapter I'll talk about is they have one for hospitals as receivers. So specifically, if you're a hospital with the expectation to receive patients, like in an emergency department, there's some requirements in the standard that talk about having two means of communications with your first response community, exercising with your first response community on an annual basis, and specifically planning for how you will manage spontaneous arrivals. When you look at some of the incidents that have happened recently, like Vegas, or Orlando, or even back to the Aurora shooting in Colorado at the movie theater. There are specific examples of hospitals being completely overwhelmed and unaware of how many more patients are coming and being unable to get additional resources because they had no situational awareness. So the standard provides some help in preventing that from happening in the future. So it covers quite a few things. And like I said, it really does affect the whole community, from the public citizen through community education, all the way to the first receiver, all the way to the recovery and in perpetuity. So big bite of the apple.
Well, there certainly is a lot of content for people to use, which leads me to my next question for Lori. I'm an AHJ. How can I use 3000 in my community?
So at the local level, whether it's a fire, police, or a local government agency, local official who wants to get the standard, they need to get the standard in their hands. They need to read it. First and foremost, read the standard. Don't just listen to what other people tell you it says. You need to go in and learn it for yourself. And that's the unfortunate part of a lot of our standards. We will listen to have somebody else tell us what it says. And often those reports, if you will, get a bit skewed. So I would just encourage you, as leaders at the local level, read the standard. It is not that long. We tried to make it concise but relevant. So it is important that you know what's in there so that you can go back and reference. You can compare it to what you've already done. You can see if there are lessons to be learned. You can see if there's anything even that we might have missed that, you know, oh, wow, this needs to be taken up, so that you can contribute back to the process as well.
The best thing you can do is find what's relevant to you. If you're a school principal, if you're a campus executive or a safety manager on a campus, find what's relevant to you, implement those components for yourself and your organization, but then reach out to your partners in response and in healthcare and in all those other facets that are in there and get them involved. Be that catalyst that gets everybody getting together. You know, a great example is a hospital. If you're a hospital and you're working to try and meet the requirements of the receiving chapter, you should be bringing in your response community and saying, hey, in order for me to do this, in order for us to do this, we need your help. And vice versa. If you're, you know, a fire or police agency or an ambulance service taking charge and saying you want to implement the things that are relevant to you, then you need those other partner organizations to work with you. So it's almost like we want it to grow organically within communities. Separately, you know, we are working really hard for leadership across the country and leadership organizations to get it and push it and get people using it. And our hope is that we build safer, more prepared communities by doing it from the top down and from the bottom up.
And John was mentioning earlier about how there is content for everyone, whether you are fire, law enforcement, EMS, hospitals, campuses. Marshall, was that the idea, to bring everyone together under one umbrella?
I think it incorporates a lot of other entities into this, because it does have to be a whole community reaction. When we look at risk mitigation, we have to take a look at where those risks exist in a community. And in addition, we need to make sure that the actions we take in reaction to any of those risks is reflective of the other needs of other constituencies that we might not recognize. For example, when we look at hardening an educational facility, we want to make sure that the practices and policies and procedures that they adopt in doing so to make the facility safe and make their constituency safe is not violating another code, you know, for lack of information and understanding. And I think this strengthens the ability to really look across the continuum and get a dialogue going that's whole community and that takes into account everybody's needs, but also make sure that we aren't violating codes in lieu of an understanding of them.
Lori, what's been the reaction of the standard now that it's out?
So far, all good things. And I think it is just starting to be read. So a lot of people have referenced it. They've heard a lot of presentations on it. And from the presentations that we're giving, that others from the committee are giving, I think the feedback from the audience is very, very good. This is needed. I'm excited to have it. I'm looking forward to reading it. But it's I think we're still on the front end of really comprehensive digestion of what's in there by a lot of our local leadership. So I think a little more time under our belts and we'll start to see more and more feedback and get a bit more use under our belts, if you will, for the standard.
Marshall, while this is predominantly a response standard, I notice there's quite a bit of emphasis on public education as well.
I think that, again, that we have the ability to utilize our terrible experience, but also to take those lessons and make sure that, you know, that when people see something, they say something, that when they're faced with one of these events, that there are certain things that they can accomplish to make themselves safer and also lead to the success of an operation related to one of these. So, for instance, the run, hide, fight process is very important, and that's a public education component so that, again, when tragedy strikes, people have the ability to impact these incidents, and I think that we raise the quotient through public education.
It's really obvious that there's a lot of information in 3000. If people want more about it, John, where should they go?
Best place to go is www.nfpa.org/3000.
Well, we've been talking about the new document, NFPA 3000, which is a standard for an active shooter hostile event response program, with John Montes from the NFPA, Lori Moore Merrill from the IFF, and Peter Ostrowski, the Massachusetts State Fire Marshal, who are all on the committee to develop this standard, and I really appreciate all of you taking the time and joining us today. Again, if you're looking for more information on NFPA 3000, you can go to www.nfpa.org/3000, and I'll be sure to include the links in the show notes below as well. And if you're looking for more information on community risk reduction, be sure to visit the Vision 2020 Project at www.strategicfire.org/CRR, where you'll find guides, videos, toolkits, and a whole lot more. And be sure to subscribe to CRR Radio, now in our second season, where you can listen to other episodes. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Ed Camo, and thanks for listening to CRR Radio.
Thanks for joining us on CRR Radio from the Vision 2020 Project. For more information on community risk reduction, please visit us at www.strategicfire.org.